the House Committee on Human Services on today, March 4th, and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2600. Healy.
House Bill 2600 requires providers of transient lodging ensure the availability of a lift system to allow persons with disabilities access to the bed, toilet, and shower or bathtub. This only applies to newly constructed facilities of 50 or more rooms or to facilities that are being remodeled, renovated, or reconstructed after the effective date. I would call your attention to, you've been provided some written testimony from Bill Lynch of the Oregon Disabilities Commission, who is in favor of this bill, and that is with your packets.
Great. Thank you. And I think we have two people signed up to testify, two representatives, Representative Mitch Greenlick and Representative Arnie Roland.
Hi.
And whomever is ready to speak first, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's great to be here in front of a committee I haven't really sat before or talked before, so I appreciate the opportunity to you and your distinguished colleagues. I'm, for the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am the representative from House District 9, which encompasses the Oregon Dunes, a wonderful part of Oregon. And I came today because when I was looking over some of the bills, this is one that hit a chord for me from my 32 years in public education, and the last 16 of which were as the high school principal at Marshfield High School in Coos Bay. We made some decisions when I was principal to move our multiple handicap classroom to the main hallway directly across from the principal's office because I had talked with a number of parents, and the feeling was that they really needed to be incorporated into the main part of our campus, and many of these students were in wheelchairs and had other assistive devices, and generally at that part of the building were where all the seniors congregated, and it became a really positive experience for our seniors to show by example how they worked with other people who were not as fortunate as they were. And we developed a really great cadre of student assistants for the classroom, and it was amazing to watch a group of students blossom in the 4 years they were at the high school, and some as many as 6 years at the high school, or seven, depending on if they stayed until they were 21 to get services. What we found, and I think what consistently found, was that a number of these students were very, very bright, but they had disabilities that limited their mobility. And I found out early in my Dean of Students career, so that goes back even a little further, that trying to move a person from a wheelchair to a bathroom stall or to lay down was an amazingly difficult task. An individual by themselves, even though I was much larger than many of these students, had a difficult time, and unless you were trained, you had a really good chance of hurting your back, causing injury. And it also puts these people in very, very, what I call, almost humiliating experiences. And that was a frustration to me. It was how do you help these people? And then we started getting lifts, and it was just an amazing opportunity. We could have the assistants who know the person, work with them all the time, go into a restroom and help that person move from the wheelchair directly to the toilet. All of a sudden, they had a different kind of dignity, and they didn't. They were trained repeatedly on how to go about eating appropriately, so that they knew their body rhythms. I mean, it's hard for me to explain to people how rigid and cycled their lives had to be so they wouldn't find themselves in bad situations which they couldn't handle at different times. The other thing that I came to understand a little bit better over time, because a lot of our students also went off as military people, and many of them are coming back today with very, very debilitating injuries. And these are people who previous in their lives got around, did all sorts of other kinds of things, and now they're relegated to wheelchairs. And when I saw this bill, it just, the light came on that this is one of those bills that gives an opportunity for a whole group of people in our society to take a trip with their families. If you look at these lift machines, they don't fit in your car. I mean, they aren't really heavy. They've made them lighter and lighter, but they're large because they have to have the balance to be able to lift. And so taking them with you doesn't seem to be a real reasonable deal. But all of a sudden when I saw this bill, I said, wow, this would give those people the opportunity to come to the coast, go to these other places where there are hotels and other things available, and have the person who cares about them and cares for them oftentimes go with them. And they could spend the night at the beach and look out the windows, and they could go to other places in this Oregon and see it. And I think they have every right to do that. And it's not that big a cost. Having looked at the cost of these, they range, if you go online, from about $600 to a couple $1,000, depending on what you want to buy. I thought about it for a long time and said, what other kinds of issues would there be related to this? And one of them is there are... individuals have different kinds of harness structure that they attach these to, depending on their structure themselves. And I thought, you know, the person, if they know that they're going to go to a hotel that has a lift, all they have to do is bring their harness with them. I wouldn't think that the hotels would have to even provide the harnesses. Each of the individuals have their own harnesses. So they could bring that with them. That wouldn't be a responsibility of them trying to figure out what kind of harness they wanted to use. And then I also thought, whenever we put things in hotels or other places, we worry about, does that cause a liability? And I think about our coast again, and on the liability on our coast, we have people and places that have skim boards and all sorts of things. They obviously have dealt with liability in the past. The people who are coming have been trained and spent a lot of time knowing how to use this equipment. I find that very, very minor opportunity. And the second thing is, in most of those places, you could easily have a signed sheet that releases liability if I use the lift machine. So I've tried to figure out, are there any reasons why people wouldn't want to do this? And I really can't think of it. I would hope that a lot of people, just after hearing the bill, would think, maybe we should go get these on our own and have them there anyway, even if we're not having the improvements or the new building, because I think it would open up another market for people, and they would be coming to these places. So, for me, great bill. I appreciate the opportunities that we've had over the years to start to recognize that with very little effort, we can help people become more and more contributing to both their own life and the lives of all of us. So, I hope that you consider this bill and move forward. Thank you very much for the time to testify. Any questions? I'm happy.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm very happy to be here. I'm Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I find myself in the unusual position of, for 2 days in a row, having testified about my personal health experience, but I think it's relevant to the bill yesterday, and it's relevant again to this bill. About 10 days before the 2007 session, I was leaving the Rose Garden after a Blazer basketball game and fell and knocked the quadriceps off both my knees. And that required, as some of you remember, double knee surgery. I was in a brace, and I was I had a big problem as to how I was going to function at the legislature under those circumstances. We were able to make accommodations that made it possible. We had the resources to rent a two-bedroom suite at the Marriott Residence Inn and equip one of the two rooms as a hospital room with hospital beds and commodes and all the facilities we needed there, and we're fortunate enough to have the availability in one of those rooms for a roll-in bathroom, roll-in shower, and it made it possible with some other accommodations. I had to accommodate by having wheelchair transit bringing me to the legislature and taking me home each day, or taking me back to Portland when we went back to Portland for the weekend, and the legislature was wonderful at making accommodations and being able to get a commode chair for me. And I had, as some of you remember, a hospital bed in my office, because that was what was required for me to be able to function in my job. And because of those accommodations, I essentially was able to function normally in my job, making a little bit of a fuss, wandering around in my short pants and double braces, but basically I was able to function. And it was very important to me. I didn't miss a session. I didn't miss a day of session in the 2007 session because I was able to make these accommodations. Living in a wheelchair for about 6 weeks and sort of wandering around, it gave me a very interesting perspective on how hard it was. For example, I regularly go from through the third floor gallery to get to the Senate side. It's the way that I was accustomed to go, but there are two steps down to do that and two steps back up, and that made me think, well, I have to figure out a new way to do it. And it gave me, I had trouble getting in and out of my office with a wheelchair. Fortunately, we don't have that with the new design. But it, and what this was about was my ability to function as a person and my ability to function as a professional. So many jobs nowadays require travel. And I had first-hand experiences. I was on a study section for the National Institutes of Health for 3 years, and on that study section with me during that whole period was a young woman who had severe mobility disabilities, and she would bring, I watched her try and travel, and she would bring her motorized little scooter with her on an airplane. It was all kind of accommodation. The thing that I always worried about for her was what happened if there was a fire in the hotel. So we had a deal when we were in Washington or another place. She would always tell me which room she was in, and while she notified the hotel where she was, if there was a case of a fire or some other emergency, I was prepared to go and help her deal with the situation. She was a very bright young woman, a professor at Harvard at that time, an assistant professor and now a full professor. But her life required her to travel, and it was extra hard. And what this bill does is it begins to equip Oregon in a way so that the professional people, the business people, the folks who need to travel as a part of their work have the ability to do that in a little easier way than they might otherwise have. It is true. It's really nice to be on vacation and to go to the beach and to do things like that. But I think the most important thing is that we need to be making modest accommodations to make sure people who have severe mobility handicaps to be able to live a normal life. That means to be able to be the person they are at work and the person they are at home and still live with a bit of accommodation. Those folks work very, very hard to accommodate to life and to live their life. And what all this bill does is it asks the opportunity to make it a little easier, so that when you build a hotel or a motel with more than 50 beds, you make sure you have at least one room that allows the kind of accommodation, the modest kind of accommodation this bill asks. I think it's a very important thing to do. I ask you to move this bill to the House, to the House floor, and let's get on the way with it.
Thank you, Representative. You know, I didn't ask if there were questions of Representative Arnie Roblin, but why don't we have questions? So if there are any, they can answer them, and I know they're busy people, and they can move on to their other tasks. So any questions for either of these two witnesses? Representative Van Orman.
I want to understand the bill. So my questions are relative to what's being said here. That it basically applies to newly constructed facilities. It basically follows the Federal Disabilities Act that if you renovate, remodel, or reconstruct, you have to accommodate people with disabilities. So how is this going to be different from the federal requirement? Because the feds do not require this particular piece. Is that correct?
Yes, this is an added requirement above and beyond the federal law. Incidentally, if you want to see what we're talking about here, the unisex bathroom on the second floor of the building has the lift equipment we're talking about. So if you have occasion to need a restroom, the unisex one on the second floor of the House wing will show you an example of what it is we're talking about.
Third as well.
Good. Somebody has some equipment on that's causing the sound system to have problems. So could you all take out your cell phones and your Blackberries, and your blueberries and raspberries? Turn them off, not just on mute, but make sure they're completely off, because it does affect the sound system. Thank you. All right. I'm sorry to have interrupted.
No, that's quite all right. So the follow-up for me is that at this point, it doesn't affect anybody who's currently in business providing lodging, but it would apply if you build a new one, and it would apply if you remodel.
Correct. If you do a major remodel.
Do a major remodel.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, question?
Yes, Representative.
Either one of you. How many other states are doing something like this right now? I mean, moving out in the lead with this.
I don't know.
I haven't seen any, but I don't know that for a fact.
Yeah, thanks.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for being late. I was on a legislative conference call with my chamber talking about this very issue. My question is some kind of to what Representative Roblin was talking about, how some facilities may already be choosing to do this. And it's more of a free market marketing type question. But it seems as if there is a market for this or a demand or a need that some motels would choose to do it as part of a marketing tool and thus provide the service that's needed without the mandate. So I was just kind of interested in your opinion on that and what you think of that.
I think that is true, and I would, you know, my testimony was about people wanting to see the state and do those other kinds of things. But I think the place where it is even more important is what Representative Greenlick talked about, and that is that when you're talking about going to places because your business makes it, it's nice to know that there's at least one hotel or something in the vicinity that's going to do it. And it may not be because of tourism. They may have a different market that they're working with. The tourist market, I think, that free market does work. They're always looking for that next deal to bring people. In fact, the person sitting next to me was a student. There are a number of hotels along the coast that allowed dogs, for example. That doesn't happen in a lot of other places in places, but because people do travel, they make some of those accommodations. But I think that's you find that less likely in other places at times. And I think this is important enough that when people are trying to plan their lives and do other kinds of things and to continue, that we need to make sure that there are places available. I think afterwards they might find out, wow, why didn't I do this sooner? But I think that this is one of those things that need to be pushed personally.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, I think to a certain extent this is educational. Since right now when you hire an architect and they design a roll-in room, such as the room I had, it's done according to the standard architectural process. This simply reminds the architect to do one little thing more, and I think it's a very easy thing to do once you've decided to have a handicap access room, and some rooms are called handicapped access and they're wider and they make more accommodation for a wheelchair, but the kind that I have residents in, you literally could roll right into the shower. And you could roll right up to the toilet. And I think it did not have a lift, but I think if it had just been done according to the modern standards, it would have had a lift. So this simply adds that to the design characteristics that would be expected of that kind of a room.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Do you mind if I allow
Representative
Clem to speak, just in case these two gentlemen. Oh, you mind?
No.
Oh.
I do.
You're welcome to stay, but I just know that if you have to go. Okay, Representative Clem, why don't we have a test?
Oh, yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, member of this committee. My apologies for being late. I'm still learning how to get those diapers done more quickly. You know, I got to catch the comments of both of my colleagues here. I introduced the bill, House Bill 2600, with Representative Greenlick. You know, the statement, the personal is political, and I think that's what my friend was talking about. Well, Representative Roman was talking, I think, in the abstract about students that he had dealt with over the years. The person that he at least mentioned to me that he's thinking about was my best friend, Todd Nelson, and he had muscular dystrophy. He passed away in my first week in college, actually, 1990. But I was his caregiver often, most days after school for hours, for a lot of his life. And you know, there were times when I was in good shape where I could lift him, but he got to be completely dead weight at this point and heavier than I was, and I needed the lift to be able to do it. And it was he didn't like that. You know, he would have preferred to be able to do it himself. He was a very independent guy. He's a fantastic person. But we got to a point where we needed the lift. And, you know, we would figure out ways to scoot them up to the edge, and then I'd see what I could do to get them up onto the bed or onto the toilet. His parents both worked, and so there was several hours after school, and we were all low-income in this neighborhood where we took care of each other as you know, teenagers, basically. And it was a great honor and pleasure to be able to do it, but it would have been nice if we could have traveled a little together. And because once we got outside of his facility there at the house with the ramp that went up and the lift, there was no guarantee I was going to be able to get him onto a toilet somewhere where we went. And so having those facilities are really important to a person who happens to have a disability. And it is about their dignity. And I don't know that there's enough of a market to make it work. I don't think the ADA was done because there was a market and people had figured out how to tap into it. It was because there isn't enough of a market financially probably to say this for sure works. And so I've thought about it. I'm a business owner and I've thought about it. And the question is this bill, you know, overly restrictive on how we would accommodate somebody in that situation? That's essentially my interest in this bill, is I spent a lot of time using these systems, and I know that if there had been a track system that went from the bathroom to the bedroom, it would have been different, because it was use the lift to get him out of bed in the morning, and often I would stay overnight when his parents would go away and just take care of him, and then get him in the chair. We'd wheel around, get through tough corners and angles, and then get to the toilet, and then no lift there. Figure out how to get them up in the chair and slide them over. And the systems they have now that have a track that take you from the bed over to the toilet are, I wish we had them then, obviously, but it was tough. And not physically on me as much. You know, we had weight belts and things that we'd do. He just hated it. He hated that his best friend had to put him on the toilet. That's my testimony.
Thank you, Representative Klem. Representative Roblin.
I knew I anticipated the testimony of Brian, because this student changed our whole community. And I tell you that because we didn't have curb cutouts and stuff. And Todd would go all over town pointing out where they needed to be. And he would make lists, and eventually he got groups to make the cutouts. And there were times he would go wherever he wanted to go in his chair. And he would crash his chair, it would fall over, he'd be in the middle of the street and wait for people to come figure out how to help him, and he'd get helped and he'd get back and he'd come. He wanted to go to our high school because he only lived a couple blocks away. His mom worked over in North Bend, and they had a much one-story building. We had a two-story building with multiple buildings on campus, and Todd was going to be a pirate. And he came in his eighth grade year to figure out how he could get his wheelchair through this building. And we had an auditorium and had a slope floor, and it got to the next floor, and there were just a few stairs, and we figured out how to put ramps. We designed our high school because of Todd to make it accessible for kids to go all around our building. We learned that we had to worry about fire alarms, and there had to be people already ready to take him and move. And I guess that was if there was a single person in our community that changed the ability for us to recognize trapped in this wheelchair was a kid who was adventurous, wanted to do everything else everybody else had done, and he was going to do it. It was our Todd. He has a place at our school. We have a memorial where he died in his senior year at the school. It was an amazing event for our community when they all came together, and I don't know that anybody in our community doesn't realize that his life helped a whole lot of other people follow him. So I think it was important for Brian to be here to do that, but it's amazing when you give people when you believe in people enough to follow their lead and let them help you. And it was truly a remarkable event at our school. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. Representative Boone, I think you have a question, and then Representative Maher.
I want to be Brian's new best friend. I wanted to point out, though, that we have a travel agent in Astoria who specializes in trips for people with disabilities, and she has developed, along with her colleagues, a guide system, where to go in all the states, internationally, and her tours are full all the time, and they're built around places to stay that have accommodations, and those places want to be in that guide because they know they're going to fill up that room that night, you know, that when she's in town. That's and great. It's a great service.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. A couple questions. You used the term major remodel, but the plain language of the bill says remodel. And I quite honestly do not trust the rulemaking process when it comes to language like this. So I would have a concern that...
And in the federal law, it says it's basically the same thing. When you remodel, especially in public buildings, if you do a remodel that takes X amount, then you have to also accommodate those issues. It has to be a percentage of the money that you spend on the remodel has to go to doing that. I would expect this would be kind of the same thing. But if that needs something, we can...
All right. And then follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
And then the other one is it's about the requirement that the section of... A lift system shall be made available at no cost to the person with a disability. I'm assuming these machines aren't free. I would assume they're quite expensive. And so do the folks get a discount on the price of the room? Because at some point, the cost of this machine is going to be included in the into the cost of the room. And so I'm assuming I'm not quite sure what the language means, because to me it would say you'd have to give them a discount on the room because someone else then has to pay for it.
My assumption is that when you build a hotel, you have expenses. This is a relatively modest expense, and it's one room out of more than 50. So I mean, my assumption is it's amortized into the cost structure of the institution, and the rates of a room aren't necessarily related to the cost of building it. They're related usually to the view. If you have an ocean view, it doesn't cost any more to have an ocean view than to have a parking lot view, but the room rate's different, and that's amortized into the whole price of the room. A single room and a double room, it doesn't cost you more to have two people in a room than one, but the rate's different. So my understanding here is that we're talking about a couple thousand dollars amortized into a multi-million dollar price of a new hotel. And it simply states that you can't charge a person, if that room rents regularly for $150 a night, you can't charge somebody $175 because they need the lift. Basically, that's, I think, all that this is referring to.
Okay.
Representative Freeman.
You had just mentioned, thank you, Madam Chair. You had just mentioned the cost of this apparatus was a couple thousand dollars.
I think that's what it is.
Is there a way we can kind of find that out? Because that seems like much different than what some of my people were concerned about.
You can go online. I think the cheapest I've ever seen is $600, up to $2,000 or $3,000. So, I mean, I go and look online. They have come down in price. They're actually a lot lighter. They move around much easier because they've gotten better materials and so on and so forth. But it's just the lift that you can move to the bed. You can use that same lift and move it into the restroom. But I think you can go online and check if you want to.
We have three more people coming to testify. So do you think you could hold your question, or is this something about
just this? Needed to clarify what
sure,
it was
go ahead.
Saying. So we're not talking about a harness that's attached to a ceiling or anything. We're talking about a mobile unit that could lift somebody up.
I think they could do that if they wanted, but the ones that we used at schools were mobile. You'd move them over to the corner, and I from here, I don't think it says it has to be built into the wall or built into the bathroom or whatever. And I would have picked, if I was going to do it, I'd pick a mobile one because it's a lot easier. They have a wheels on the bottom, and they go underneath. Then they come up. There's a little lift thing at the top, and you can crank it up. So once you've attached your harness to it, you can lift them out of the chair, move the chair out of the way, and then move them to the place they need to be.
If I were designing it, I'd
put it in the wall.
I'd put it in the wall.
They could do it
because it's
way
much more stable in that model. But again, I assume if this is a problem, you'll have negative testimony from the hotel industry, and I don't know whether there is or there isn't. It's really modest. I mean, when you're building a 50-room hotel, nobody's going to notice the extra cost of this.
Any further questions? Thank you both very
Thank
much.
You.
Have a great stay the rest of the day. We have Nicole Armstrong, Jeff Hampton, and Todd Kennedy. Somebody still has some electronic on. It's still causing trouble in the sound system. Could you check your electronics again, please, and make sure that they're all off? And they have to be completely off, not just on mute.
Mine won't go off. I normally don't bring it, so I'm thinking maybe it's mine, but I can't get it to turn off.
Maybe Representative Freeman can help you turn it off.
I have my big shoes on.
How much is it worth to Representative Roland and Clem to do that?
I don't know how to turn it off.
Well, it just turns off.
I was wondering that could might be the wheelchair. Okay, Todd. Todd.
You don't have to turn it off, Todd.
Okay, whoever wants to go first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And I'll just speak briefly in support of this bill as an association that works very hard to advocate for the needs of people with disabilities. We think that this bill is definitely a step in the right direction to start the conversation about how to look at enabling people to have more independence in a variety of situations. We'd like to remind you that when we talk about disability, it doesn't necessarily just mean younger people with physical disabilities. A number of older adults certainly come upon these same situations when trying to travel, trying to find accommodation, because impairment hits us all eventually as we start aging farther into our lives. I can speak for our association as an organization that does have a number of individuals with disabilities that work with us. We have a very difficult time finding accommodations for our conferences and our events that can accommodate the specific needs of a person who needs some help and additional assistance using the facilities within their room. And it's always an interesting dilemma for us, bringing a number of people into a specific town and not being able to find that kind of an accommodation. It puts us in quite a dilemma. I did a quick search last night looking for hotels that have this kind of accommodation. What was interesting is how many of them I found in Europe. I thought that was really interesting to see that it seems like in England they have a very strong sense of this as a responsibility of their travel industry. I thought that was really interesting, but I had a hard time finding them here. We support making those kinds of accommodations to support universal design and to help people and their families be able to enjoy a lot of different activities here within the state. And so I would ask for your support in keeping this conversation going. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole.
Hello, my name is Todd Kennedy. I live in District 23, Representative Thompson's district. I come to you with a disability who does travel. I've traveled all over the United States. Hardly ever we have to call ahead, have a lift system brought in from a rental company through a place in the area if they have them. By traveling around the state, I do have a wife who's about half my weight, and she cannot physically pick me up and move me around, so we do travel with a lift. But then we have to go to more of an upscale hotel where they do have a bellhop who can take the lift out of the car, take it to the room, and put it together for us, because she does not have the physical strength to do it. It is light, but she does have a bad back, so she cannot do that. We have to go where there's a bellhop, so we cannot, or we have to go to a hotel what has a handyman, and we have to be there at their hours so they can put it together for us, and then we have to leave on their hours so they can take it apart. And to the cost of what Representative Maurer was asking earlier about, typically, from my experience, handicap accessible rooms, they're typically a suite because there always has to be bigger for a wheelchair to move around in. So we're already paying more money just for a handicap accessible room, even though they don't say it, but their suites are the ones they've decided to turn into their handicap accessible rooms, and I think that it is just part of the business process, and it's okay, but I would like to be able to travel to some of the not as nice hotels, as I don't make that much money, to be able to work, and then they don't have bellhop, so it's just a very hard situation to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd. Any questions of Todd? All right, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jeff Hampton. I'm the president and CEO of the Oregon Lodging Association. We're based in Wilsonville, and I reside in historic, beautiful, historic Oregon City, I'd say as well, just to get historic Oregon City on the record. With regard to this bill, our industry is proud to serve as ambassadors for our state. Often when visitors travel into Oregon and throughout Oregon into our communities, the hotel or motel front desk person is the first person they meet, and we're proud of that role that we play. We make compliance with national ADA laws a top priority, and accessibility for all of our guests is a value that we embrace. We do have some concerns related to House Bill 2600, however, and specifically they relate to liability and risk management within our properties. I just did a quick survey of our membership, and I don't find the lift devices or lift systems that I think this bill looks to incorporate as prevalent or even available in many of them. I will tell you that. And many of our members weren't, while they may have track systems that allow access into swimming facilities and spa facilities, the pools at properties, they aren't aware of these devices, and it's not an industry widely used industry device. One of the significant concerns that we have with House Bill 2600 relates to potential liability that exists if a business provides a piece of equipment for a guest who then suffers harm or an injury as a result of malfunction of the equipment or misuse. I believe that it was discussed earlier that there were harnesses that accompany or are used with these devices. And I understand that the guest will bring the harness themselves. I also understand there are a variety of these devices available on the market, and I don't currently know whether or not there's an issue with compatibility. A harness that's built for one device may not be compatible with a harness for another device. And as you look at the potential of a guest misusing or trying to fit a harness that isn't compatible with the device that's on site, that may create some potential liability or harm that results from that. I'm also unclear as to what the liability would be, and I raise the issue only because these are the things our members have brought as well related to whether or not hotel or motel staff, and my belief is they would need to check out the guests, so to speak, on the use of the equipment to ensure that the directions on how to use the equipment properly were disclosed. And I know there was mention of a waiver of some sort. I don't know, frankly, not being an attorney, what that waiver would provide our members in terms of a mitigation of that liability. But there certainly is liability that exists whenever you're providing a device or piece of equipment for guests to use that potentially could cause injury if misused. I suppose the last thing I might like to say is that currently lodging facilities in Oregon don't have maintenance staff or a handyman or other folks on staff that have the expertise or the training to maintain these devices, as our industry doesn't use them currently. There's a question about when these devices fall into disrepair or if they malfunction, if there's some problem with it and they're not functioning whatsoever, how is a hotel property, what liability they incur potentially based on that as well. So I provided written testimony as well, of course.
Thank you very much for providing the written testimony. It's always good for us to keep it in our files, so thank you for that. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Sure, Jeff Hampton.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate
the reference to Oregon City since I was a city commissioner there for a few years. But my question is, when you took the survey, did the lodging people understand that it isn't impacting them now in their current business? It would only impact on new construction or renovation?
Madam Chair and Representative Van Orman, yes. I made the bill available to them and, of course, let them know my understanding of it. There are significant questions that the bill just simply doesn't answer. And the concern, again, was related to the liability issues, primarily based on the harnesses, compatibility, malfunction, or misuse of the device that might create a injury that results in liability. ADA, National ADA law does require, and I think the language that's in the bill is a change of usability. I've contacted the American Hotel Lodging Association in Washington, D.C. to help them, or to ask them, rather, to help me understand what that change of usability entails. And while the representative earlier mentioned that it's a remodel or renovation, it's not clear. Department of Justice has not yet given reply back with regard to current ADA law as to whether that means a change of curtains or a change of carpet or a significant seismic renovation to meet seismic code regulation. So there's significant question there as well, and our members simply don't know what level of renovation this would entail and are concerned about the liability issue.
Thank you. Representative Cowan and then Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions, if I could. Todd, the first one to you. There was some question raised about cross-compatibility with the type of harness that any one individual would need. You've used a variety of lifts and probably have as much expertise as anybody in this room at this moment. Is there a difference in the lift that you would need to hook any given harness?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, they're typically all a center hook. Then from that center point, you can hook onto different slings and spread bars. And so I would think, as the bill's written, that they would just have to supply the lift with a typical center point of lifting capability, and the occupants would be required for supplying everything from that point down. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I'm making an assumption that individuals who have a need for this type of equipment have a pretty good idea of what harness it is that they might need and what and how it would connect to any given device. So it does sound like there's some standardization or commonality, I guess. It appears to me that the concerns of the industry are certainly valid. Anytime a survey is done for a complete unknown that doesn't exist within the facility's understanding, there's going to be concerns raised and a lack of a knowledge base because they're not using them currently. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be. And I came in here today with a very open mind. I will have to admit that the testimony has brought back some personal experiences and with individuals, and I have a strong leaning now. So I guess the question I have for any of you who are sitting here at the panel, is there anyone willing to take on addressing the educational needs that will go with, should this bill be successful? There's also going to be a need to get out and help facilities understand what it is they need and how it could be accommodated. And, you know, I don't know if I'm looking at Nicole now. Organizations that help people with disabilities could help supply some of that information, or if there is another one that might be able to take on that role. The specific individual in my community who took on that role as a passion for years is one that educated me, but he is unfortunately now deceased. And believe me, he educated me thoroughly before that time. So I'm just curious if anybody has thought about that.
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, I think that certainly through the area agencies and our disability advisory councils, that's something that we'd be able to work with the other stakeholders within the disability community that we work with regularly to provide that kind of information if there was a, you know, if that was kind of the direction that we were headed, because certainly it's independence is an issue we're terribly passionate about. So I think we would be able to help with that.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You know, I'm somewhat skeptical because this is new, and I, you know, the movement of the disabled is clearly an issue. But you know, when you're talking money and liability, there's a whole bunch of questions that still need to be answered. And I, you know, I couldn't support the bill as written because there's still a lot of unanswered questions. I mean, quite frankly, I don't know what the liability response would be, and I'd be interested from an insurance company's perspective on what they thought the increased liability might be. And I'd like to actually see it from both sides, you know, the advocates and the industry, to ask that question. What do you, you know, what is this going to cost us? Because I'm not sure that it's going to end up costing you that much, assuming you have appropriate equipment. The equipment, I'm looking at a system now that's used in hospitals, $3,000 to $6,000. Actually, that's a lot less than I thought it would be. And this is an overhead system. And so there's just some unanswered questions that I think I need to have answered. Another one is overweight limiting, that most machine says it won't operate if it's overloaded. Well, if the machine is installed and you have someone that's obese and can't use the machine because it's overweight, who's responsible? Is it the hotel now responsible to go find a new machine that can accommodate the weight? Or, I mean, it's just some of those issues are, I think, are important to answer because this is going to be liberally interpreted during the rulemaking process. And that's my hesitation. So, you know, I think maybe there is an accommodation here, a compromise that's acceptable, but I just want to make sure we're not putting someone out.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair and Representative Maurer, I did speak, and this is anecdotal, but I will be happy to get more information from our end. I know you're asking for information from insurance providers as well as probably attorneys with regard to the potential liability issue, but I did speak with insurance providers yesterday and asked specifically about the devices. The places that the person I spoke with, that they were familiar with these being used, were in hospitals and assisted living facilities. And the one comment that was made is that they mitigate their risk as a business by having trained staff that are required to assist in the operation of these devices.
That would be in a hospital or an assisted living
That's
situation,
correct.
Not in a lodging situation.
That's correct.
Thank
they
you.
Require a trained staff.
Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Maurer brought up some, I think, thought-provoking questions, which leads me to, and Todd, I don't know if you would be the one to respond to this on behalf of the bill or not, but possibly Todd and Jeff both, is the bill in concrete and there's no compromise at all, I guess would be the question to Todd, and then to Jeff, the same question, or is there a willingness to maybe get together and see if there's some work that can be done on it? You know, one of the points, I'm not comfortable as a business person to just say that I'll spend $3,000 to supply this piece of equipment for a room. And today we're talking about a lift. Tomorrow it could be something else that I would be required to put into a room. But Representative Greenlick, I don't think really comprehended the economics of how you put together a business and recoup your expenses. you have to have a profit somewhere along the line to stay in business, and I can't be required to spend $600 or $3,000 on a provision and not be able to recoup my expense somehow. So that's just one of the points. So I guess I'm asking, is there willingness on all parties to work on something to compromise? Because I can also see the benefit of this also.
I think what I have in mind is perhaps, I think some excellent questions have been raised, that perhaps, again, we should put up another work group that would include the advocates and also...
She was trying to volunteer me, Madam Chair, and that was inappropriate. I like to
ask the question.
And also the stakeholders.
How many works?
So I think we will try to do that.
Okay, thank you.
That would be good.
Any further questions before we have to move on? Okay, thank you for bringing this before us, thank you for coming to talk with us about your concerns, and we will try to move on. And I do wonder would be willing to work on this outside of the committee hearing. And I don't think it should take a lot of time. Oh, thank you, Representative Freeman. Anyone else?
To do what?
Thank you.
Oh, nice to be a volunteer.
See how easy that was, Madam Chair?
No.
Sure. She was just telling me she had a clear understanding of what needed to be done.
Auctions too.
Thank you so much. We'll wait to hear from you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2600. We have people from out of town who are here to talk with us about 2134, so we're going to hold over House Bill 2622, and I know Representative Beyer was here, and she's come and gone, so we'll hold that over until what, Monday?
Another day.
Okay. And so we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2134. Keeley. Is that okay? Does anybody have heartburn with that?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
Hostile 21.
Just work group.
Just not enough to work group. Hostile 21-34 is for contractors engaged in activities involving lead-based paint. It removes the licensing authority from the Construction Contractors Board and places it with Department of Human Services, and enables DHS to develop and prescribe by rule a program for the certification of individuals performing lead-based paint activities and set workplace standards for safe practices.
Thank you very much, Keeley.
So,
Doug Farquhar and
Barbara Ross are both from out of town.
Okay, let's hear from Doug Farquhar, Barbara Ross, and who's here from DHS? Go ahead, Gail. Come on up. Was there anybody else from DHS who wanted to testify?
Madam Chair, no. Construction Contractors Board is here also, so
right.
I'm happy to either go with or as you suggest.
Why don't you go ahead?
Okay.
And then maybe we should hear from the Contractors Board. Is that what we should do?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Public Health Division of Oregon's Department of Human Services. I've provided for you today, in addition to written copies of my testimony, several pieces which I'll go through here in just a moment. I appreciate very much the hearing on this bill. We are literally in the midst of discussions and refinements and changes. In fact, I literally was just handed some Dash 1 amendments that I haven't even had a chance to look at yet. So we're not quite ready for any official movement on this bill, but I'm very optimistic that we'll be there very, very soon. This bill, Madam Chair, does two things. It was designed to and intended to provide the statutory authority for the State of Oregon Public Health Division to negotiate successfully with the United States Environmental Protection Agency to take on what's known as primacy in the cooperative federalism mode of federal-state programs, so that we implement a federal requirement. In this case, there is a new about to become effective regulation by the U.S. EPA that deals with renovation, repair, and painting, affectionately known as the RRP rule. And I'm so glad to have EPA Region 10 here with me today. So all of your questions about the specific scenarios and what-ifs and why-fors, gladly defer to my federal colleague. The second thing that the bill is attempting to do is use this opportunity to figure out if we can streamline within the state of Oregon how we oversee and work with those individuals who deal with lead-based paint and do it efficiently and effectively. That's sections six and seven of the bill as introduced. Regarding the first point, as I said, this RRP rule will require all firms that do renovation work on "quote unquote" target housing and child-occupied facilities, and those are referenced, I think, in the language of 2134, but it really is based on the definition in the federal rule to be trained and certified. That includes accrediting curriculum, accrediting training providers, and certifying firms. We are within public health. We have been dealing with lead-based paint now for well over a decade. We have a series of programs with our partners at the federal level, and we really see this as a very important, probably the most important additional tool in our continuing effort to reduce elevated blood lead levels in children and lead poisoning. As I mentioned, as with many programs, Oregon really has a choice. Either we implement it ourselves or the federal government will implement it. And without the authority in 2134, national or regional EPA will be implementing this rule. We determined...
Could you repeat that again? I think that's an important thing for us to hear.
Sure, Madam Chair. The choice is not whether there will be new requirements and new regulations and fees. The question is, who will implement this new requirement? Will it be the state of Oregon or will it be the federal government? And after consideration of the requirement and discussing both the policy as well as the practical implications of doing that, we determined that the state can do it with all due respect to very important colleagues at the federal level, better, faster, cheaper, or at least as well as on all of those fronts. And consequently, it just made more sense. We could be more responsive and be more nimble than trying to deal with regional or national federal colleagues. As I mentioned, DHS has been working on lead-based paint and lead in toys, lead in pottery, lead in jewelry, and in every other product for quite some time. We are very focused on and concerned about lead and how potent it is as a neurotoxin, particularly for children. As the Chair and Representative Cowan in particular know, we are within environmental public health, we are dealing with a wide variety of concerns around environmental contaminants. As their membership in the House Consumer Protection Committee will attest, we've had some good discussions about some significant environmental contaminants. I have to say, with all of my focus and concern about that, we simply have got to deal with lead, and we have not nearly to the extent that we can and we should. And I think this with this rule, we are now being able to deal with this in a much more effective, much broader, much more focused way. The second thing that this bill does, which is sections 6 and 7 of the bill, as I mentioned, is an attempt to say, look, we now regulate lead-based paint abatement. And abatement, of course, is a term of art, so to speak, where the focus of the project is actually to contain and remove or otherwise seal up lead-based paint. I am in the midst of talking to to and working with both my colleague at Construction Contractors Board as well as other stakeholders in this to see if is this the right approach to take. I am determined that we can improve how we do things, exactly how we implement even this new rule. I want to provide us the flexibility within our executive branch agencies to figure out how we can do this with just as efficiently and as responsively as possible. I am very familiar with the concerns of regulated entities within DHS, for example. We do trade competency for drinking water system operators, for backflow and cross-connection prevention specialists, for clandestine drug lab cleanup contractors, a variety of folks in a variety of settings. And consequently, I work with regulated entities all the time, and I really take it very very much to heart that we have a responsibility as public administrators to do the very best job we can to make it as clean and efficient and transparent as we possibly can, and I'm committed to doing that. If I might, Madam Chair, I'll end there, but I just want to flip through some of the various paperwork that I provided the committee. One is certification fees for lead-based paint. If I'm making sure that I'm reading this correctly, I don't want to misconstrue anything here. There, we have annualized fees paid to.
Hold up the item you're speaking
about. I'm sorry. It says certification fees.
Thank you.
The table. Yeah. And we have annualized fees that are now paid to DHS and CCB for, again, the abatement program. The abatement effort is the only piece that is currently regulated. And so there are five different classifications for abatement activities, and you see those there: inspector, risk assessor, supervisor, worker, project designer. And then there is a firm fee as well, a company fee, if you will. The proposed, again, these are annualized fees, and these are proposed EPA fee schedule. Now, EPA, and as the EPA representative can attest, I think they are looking at a five-year, I think, recertification schedule, something like that. But what we did to try to provide you apples-to-apples comparison was just annualize what those would be. And again, these are EPA proposed as published in the Federal Register. They're not what we are proposing. Again, we are convinced that we can come in under those numbers and certainly no more than those numbers. So I just want to provide that in terms of kind of helpful context and frankly to let you know that we are very mindful of the fees and this is not a small kind of insignificant issue. The second piece is
I just want to make sure that I'm clear there, Gail. So
yes.
What you're saying is that this is what EPA, if it were this study were this work were taken on by the federal agency, this is what they would charge, and you're saying that the state would charge no more than this. If the state took over this program, it would probably charge less. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
I will note that under the proposed yearly fee, I just caught this, and I apologize, I didn't raise this earlier, on the right-hand side where it has certification and then CCB fees and then the total, what sections 6 and 7 of the bill as currently, as you've got in front of you, those fees would be rescinded. We would eliminate a schedule of fees for all five of those classifications. And as my colleague, the director of CCB, I'm sure can share, those are a very small number of people pay those fees. I'm not trying to overblow, you know, wow, we're eliminating a fee schedule, which is always a great thing to do. When you can, but nonetheless, we think that this is an opportunity to, as I said, streamline and consolidate. We may or may not depending on what happens with Section 6 and 7 of the bill, we may decide that, you know what, we'll deal with that at a different time or a later time. Perhaps concurrent authority makes some sense, et cetera. I think what I'm trying to say is that we've got the makings of a small work group, Madam Chair and members, that we would like to have some additional time so that we can get together. I think we're close to consensus, but we're not quite there as I speak to you today. So I just wanted to explain what that means by rescind there. That's with the bill as currently written. Bless you. So the second piece is just and it's an interesting stapling job here, I think, but has led glossary and the CCB statutes. I think those were provided really because they were referenced in the bill, and we just wanted to share with the committee so that you wouldn't have to go scrambling to the bookshelves there. But and then the I believe the lead glossary, that is from the Code of Federal Regulations. So those are the definitions by the federal government. The third piece is we hope a little easier to read than something like this, which is the federal rule. But it is a synopsis of the federal rule that kind of says what does it do, who's covered, what's the role of this entity and that entity. Let's see, and then the last piece. Because I know there's a lot of very easy confusion or just frustration that, wait a minute, how many different people come on a job site? How many bureaucrats does it take to get somebody licensed to do a particular job? Again, as an administrator, I'm very sensitive to those kinds of issues and questions, and there's no question that when you deal with a group of firms, some of whom are licensed contractors, then very appropriately and understandably, those firms deal with Construction Contractors Board. As this couple sheets identifies, though, within Oregon, for better or worse, the architecture that has been established for dealing with a variety of health and safety issues means that different agencies throughout the executive branch also deal with those same regulated entities for one reason or another, whether it's, as I said, backflow installation or repair or crane operators or elevator work or drain plumbing, et cetera. And so I wanted to offer this to you, and what I hope is a helpful kind of, oh yeah, okay, I understand, here's who you go to, and I want to say thank you to Construction Contractors Board. I think literally we got this off the website, but just wanted to share that with you. So, Madam Chair, I'll be happy to provide any information that the committee finds helpful, but I'll now turn to my colleagues.
Okay. Would you like us to ask questions right now, or do you want to wait until everybody is?
Madam Chair, I'll do whatever you wish, but I would recommend waiting till the end.
Great. Okay. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm Barbara Ross, and I'm from the Environmental Protection Agency. I want to thank you very much, Madam Chair and representatives, for allowing us to be here today to talk to you. EPA's goal is to eliminate childhood lead poisoning, and childhood lead poisoning is preventable. I handed you a chart. It's a very colorful chart, and it shows the sources of lead poisoning. And what it clearly shows is that remodeling is the largest source of lead poisoning, and this rule is to protect children from exposure during remodeling. It applies to housing and child care facilities built before 1978, and it applies to contractors who disturb painted surfaces in homes and daycare centers. It applies to painters, carpenters, renovators, electricians, plumbers, and landlords. And the new rule requires the contractors to be trained to follow lead-safe work practices and to protect children from lead. The firms must be certified. Not everybody needs to be certified, but the firms must be certified and individuals must be trained. The certification class is an 8-hour class. If somebody already has lead training, they take a 4-hour refresher class. The new rule can be run either by EPA or the state. The new rule will be in effect. EPA will begin doing things under the rule this next month, April 2009, and the rule will be totally in effect in April 2010. And it's not a question of whether the rule will be in Oregon or not. The question is, will EPA run the rule or will Oregon run the rule? And we encourage the state to take on the rule. They have the advantage of their existing infrastructure. Oregon's been running the lead program for over 10 years, and EPA has been awarding grants every year to Oregon to run the lead program, and we'd like to continue that partnership because we feel that Oregon's been doing an excellent job. This program also has fee revenues, and the fee revenues combined with the EPA grant should make the program self-sufficient. There are some benefits for a state program. It can be better designed. The states are more in touch with contractors. It can be tailored. It's a question of whether you want a program that's a federal program, one size fits all, the same program in New York, Alaska, Oregon, in all the states, or do you want a program tailored to the site-specific needs of Oregon? And the state can have a better targeted, a better enforced, and a more effective program. The state can charge fees, and they can also qualify for federal grants once they take on the program. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for coming all this way.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Doug Farquhar. I'm with the National Conference of State Legislatures. I just want to let you know I'm in a neutral position on this. I'm not either in favor or against the bill, but I did want to give you a little bit of understanding about what other states are doing and some issues involving renovation and remodeling. This regulation, the authorization for it, came from a law known as Title 10 that passed in 1990 under the first Bush administration. And that is the law that got EPA in the job of training and certifying contractors who did abatement work in housing. Was one of the foremost efforts that it did, which was a fairly substantial operation. Many states adopted these laws, took authorization on. 40 of the 50 states took this on, District of Columbia. Several Indian tribes took this effort on. One of the elements in that law, though, also said EPA must look at renovation remodeling. What does that do? What is the impact on the public? That was an enormous task for them to look at. It took several years to do the studies. It took several years to make the analysis move forward. Once they got the analysis together, though, they did take a, they were under a requirement under this law to regulate if they found a hazard there. Well, they did find a hazard. The hazard was very clear that renovation and remodeling work does create elevated blood leads in children, and not only in the children of the people of who live in those homes, but also the workers, the children of the workers, because when they come home, they have this dust on them. They have all the thing that contractors get when you do any sort of renovation or remodeling. So EPA was under the requirement to move forward. This rule came out, was promulgated under the second Bush administration. It was required to be moved forward no matter who won the election last time. But at this point, we only have one state officially authorized to legislatively to take on that program, and that's California. And that's because they had, in years gone past, passed a law that said we are going to do address renovation remodeling. Now, there are some other states out there that their state legislation is very wide open, where there is an argument that can be made. Utah is an example. Kansas is another example. But there are many states, vast majority of states, this authority is not there. And I believe Oregon would be considered one of them. And I'm not going to be the ultimate decider on that. That would be the Oregon Attorney General. But anyway, Oregon is one of the many states where this authorization would be needed to accept the EPA program. Lead hazards in renovation remodeling range on depending on the state. What I mean by that is when you go back east and you look at the older homes, homes built not only before 78 but 1950 when the lead industry started or the paint industry started voluntarily taking lead out of paint. And they did that because they found better substitutes. But that's where you see a majority of the homes that were built before 1950. Now, obviously, there are areas in the West and areas in Oregon where you see a large number of homes built before 1950, built before 1978, where you're going to see this hazard be more prevalent. But when you look back east, majority of the homes are built before 1950. Majority of these homes would have required an abatement in many cases. So they had a more significant program. That wasn't the situation in the West. Most of the homes are newer. So an abatement wasn't really the element. But for renovation remodeling, that does affect a great number of people. I'm sure as you sit here in this room, you can think of the large number of times when you will have a situation where you're going to have a renovation of a home that was built before 1978. We're going to disturb more than 1 square foot of paint, which is where the EPA rule triggers, where that starts. This also impacts elementary schools and daycare centers. It will not impact middle schools. It will not impact high schools. But elementary schools where you have a situation where you get children 6 and under, then it will be taking effect. This is on one hand, a fairly simple rule. Even though it addresses several people, it really looks at just getting them trained, making sure they have an understanding of what is going on and whether they are going to be causing problems out there. The big significant thing is trying to reach all these contractors, trying to reach all these workers out there, and that's where the difficulty comes in. EPA has the authority to do that, and they have the ability to do that. They're just not going to be as effective or as efficient as the state. And that is something that we have seen over and over again in working with environmental rules, is that the state is just in a much better position to work with the public, to hear the public needs, and to be able to respond to that. And from the public, I mean the residents, I mean the schools, I mean the contractors, I mean the even union workers who are going to be affected by this. They're all in a much better state to work with the state and make this rule as efficient and as effective as possible. Just a couple points in closing. In looking at other states, a vast majority of them are done in either the Department of Health or the Department of Environment. The only states, only a couple states put them in. One's in Department of Labor, and that's in Pennsylvania. And they just did that for management reasons. For the most part, in most states, these are done, almost every state, it's done in the Department of Health or Environment, depending on how the state structure is. And the fact that this will enable Oregon to have better access to HUD funds when it comes to the federal agencies out there. HUD has the most money for renovation and remodeling. In fact, they just received another $100 million under the stimulus package to do lead-based paint renovation and remodeling. They have pretty limited requirements, but one of the main requirements is that you use trained and certified workers that meet EPA requirements. So with that, I would like to close my comments and entertain any questions from any one of us.
Representative Freeman, and then Representative Van Norman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great stuff. I mean, we're protecting kids, and we're having the state do it. Both of those things I agree with a bunch. A couple of questions, and maybe they're in the amendments, or maybe I just didn't read this right. In Section 3, you talk about, by rule, setting up the certification and performing lead-based paint activities in renovations. It's not really a description of what that is. It doesn't say it models or follows the federal requirements. So my question is it going to be any more than what the federal requirements are or only what the requirements are? And then to kind of follow up on that, by rule you're talking about setting the fees, and in your testimony you said you thought they would be the same or less than, and that's not written down here either. I was wondering if you could kind of address those two things.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, thank you very much for those questions. It is our flat-out commitment that we are not doing anything more than is required under the federal RRP rule. Now, I'll share with you that does not win me a lot of friends with a lot of very strong, involved, knowledgeable, passionate advocates. And as a public health person, I can see, you know, dare I say, improvements to the federal rule. That's not what we're focused on. We simply are faced with this issue right now. Do we do it or does Oregon do it? And the it stays the same, whether it's at the state or the federal level. So thank you for that, the opportunity to clarify that. Second, in terms of the fees by rule, I certainly commit to the fact that we are not going to charge whatever the equivalent is at the federal level to do something. Frankly, I can't justify that to my boss, that we would do something that the federal government is willing to do more cheaply. That just doesn't make any sense. Depending on specific language, I'm certainly willing to consider that maybe fees up to an amount contained in 40 CFR, you know, et cetera, so that there is a cap. But you know, that's a cap at the federal level. Again, I'm happy for that to be accountable at that level. But I'll work on the specific language. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Representative Van Norman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sitting here thinking as a former Head Start director, and I'm trying to determine how it would apply because we have a number of centers in this state. And in thinking about this, basically what we're talking about, and this is for clarification purposes for me, is we're talking about ensuring that contractors who do these kinds of operations have been certified by the state. But there's nothing particularly in here that requires me to hire contractors with this certification. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, I may ask my EPA colleague to help with this response. But what the federal rule requires, and what this language is again attempting anyway to get at, is that if you hire somebody for money, if you hire someone to disturb so much of a square footage of either of these two categories of buildings, child occupied facility or target housing, then that firm has to have an employee, at least one, maybe 50 or 500, but at least one employee of that firm has to have gone through the training that Ms. Ross described and has to be on site at the beginning of that project, has to be on site at the end of that project, and has to be available to the workers who are actually doing the work in between, so that if they blast away and they find something, they can get somebody on the horn and find out, now what do I do, et cetera. So And there is a requirement here that under Section 4 of the bill, a person may not perform or offer to perform these activities unless the person, and person, of course, as defined in statute, includes a company, is certified and or is performing these activities under the supervision of a person certified. So that is the hook. It's not trying to get at the 3.6 million Oregonians, but rather a smaller universe of those people who would actually do that work for remuneration. I hope that's responsive to your question.
I'm not sure. I'm thinking about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do we have a choice here, or is this just our choice is to basically take control or allow the feds to do it? Is that the bottom line here?
Yes.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So a lot of the requirements in here are federal EPA. Some of my concerns are the four-hour refresher course. The lead-based paint situation is not going to change from year to year. Unless we gain some new technology or something, the removal is going to remain the same. And I run into this all the time with septic tank installers. You know, that stuff still flows downhill. It doesn't change. Why do you need to require, in that particular situation, 16 hours a year, I think it is, refresher course? Because a contractor... Unless it's an online course, a contractor's probably going to have to drive from Condon to Salem. He's going to kill 13 hours in a day. He's going to lose potentially hundreds of dollars in income and have to pay for the refresher course, which is not going to teach him anything that he didn't learn in the original certification course. So those are just some of the things that I get frustrated with as we deal with situations like this.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, if I may, I hear you, and the logistical and the overall time commitment pieces of that, I can do something about. The four-hour rule, I can't, in all honesty. It's just a flat-out requirement. But what we are very focused on and committed to within DHS is continuing to work with our partners, for example, the community colleges that we already work with to provide training in a variety of other competencies, whether it's nursing and EMTs, also in public health, or whether it's cross-connect backflow prevention work, also in DHS, et cetera. And so wherever the nearest community college could be would be one example. Another piece is we've already had discussions with the Home Builders Association, and they're very interested in providing this for their members. Also talking to I mentioned my colleagues at CCB, and they're in the midst of looking at continuing education curriculum. And we would love, for example, we could see that this could be a module in that ongoing curriculum. We've also talked to the Painters Union and the apprenticeship programs. So we're very interested and committed to getting this out just as broadly as we possibly can, not only because it's good, efficient use for the workers, but frankly, it's good for public health. The more that we can get this training out, the easier we can get it done, then the safer our kids can be.
Thank you so much. Gail is going to be accessible to us. This will not obviously be the only public hearing we have on this, and Gail is going to be accessible to us so we can bring her back. But we have we have so many other people here wanting to testify in a half hour. So do we have any more questions, quick questions, for the two people who came from out of state? Yes.
Well, sorry about it. It was actually for what Gail just said.
Can it wait until we see Gail again, or is it just specifically for these two folks?
That's okay, then. Go ahead.
Actually, Barbara, I wouldn't mind asking a question.
Go ahead.
Really quick. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, the federal guidelines that are outlined for certification for first, you know, recertification for the 8 hours, 4 hours, on this for lead abatement. Does that also, is that in connection or in line with what's going on with asbestos as well?
Madam Chair and Representative Oslin, it is not related at all to asbestos. Okay. This is only lead.
Well, I understood that. I'm sorry, right. Matt, follow. I understand that they're not the same, but the concept of the certification process, same amount of hours involved with both.
Madam Chair and Representative Olson, there are some links between lead and asbestos, and some similar people, you know, have been involved in the rules, so there may be similarities there.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any quick questions for our out-of-town folks? All right. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks.
We really appreciate it. And Gail, I know we'll be seeing you again. Okay, I'm going to call Tamara Rubin up. And there was a mother, Shaylee Armstrong, who...
Did you find her?
She came right back
in.
Great. Oh, great. And I know you had your daughter with you. I'm assuming...
She'll be right back.
Okay, terrific. And is there anybody else? I know I see a lot of lobbyists and other people who are here in the building a lot. Is there anybody who is not normally in the building who would like to speak on this? And there's a lady back there whom I don't recognize. Come on up, please. And a couple of gentlemen who aren't normally in the building? Great. And another lady back there. Okay, we'll bring you up next. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Tamara Rubin. I'm a mother, a wife, a homeowner, a business owner, a landlord, and a voter. And I live with my husband and my four sons in Portland. 3 years ago, my children were poisoned by the work of a painting contractor who broke the law and charged us $18,000 for the privilege. To prepare our home in the historic Irvington for painting, he used pressure washing, dry scraping, open flame torch burning to remove the old lead paint. He told us that he was certified to safely handle lead paint, that he had been through the state certification training, and he assured us that these were the safest methods. He lied. He was not certified. He had taken the courses and failed the certification exam. He used the most dangerous methods possible. Our children... Sorry.
There's Kleenex
there. Our children inhaled the lead fumes and became violently ill. We got a call late one night with the blood test results, and our doctor told us that we needed to move out of our home immediately because our children had lead poisoned. After we learned that our children had been poisoned, we hired an abatement contractor, who we later realized followed lax protocols and told us it was safe for us to return to our home after they had completed their work. They did no clearance testing, only a white glove test, and assured us that the home was now safe to live in. When our children were poisoned again from the remaining toxic dust in our home, after we moved out again, never to return, we finally learned of clearance testing. When we finally had the clearance testing done for areas that the abatement contractor assured us were safe, play areas for our children tested hot, extremely hot, 1,100 micrograms per square foot, nearly 30 times the level that's considered safe for a child. It cost us more than $200,000 to decontaminate our home from the standard work practices of these contractors. It's left us nearly bankrupt and in foreclosure. Our financial distress pales in comparison to the permanent brain damage caused to two of our boys. They were left with severe behavioral problems, learning disabilities, sleep disorders, and eating issues, not to mention being robbed of their full potential by diminishing their IQs. If any other professional had done this sort of damage, if any other citizen had, whether through ignorance, incompetence, or cynical disregard, methodically engaged in illegal and dangerous practices resulting in the predictable poisoning of my children, or acted as an accessory to their re-poisoning through egregious malpractice, that individual would, in all likelihood, be in jail today. But since enforcement of the laws to date has been nearly impossible, and training of contractors has been limited, our contractors and hundreds of others like them are committing these same crimes over and over again with impunity. Increasing the number of trained contractors and the number of contractors who obey the law and use lead-safe work practices by allowing DHS to have oversight of training, enforcement, and compliance will be one step in the right direction to make sure this does not happen to other children. I would like to see this take Oregon on a path towards the models for training and enforcement that were set up in San Diego and are now being implemented on a local level by some of San Diego's program staff in Washington, D.C. If we can reach a point where contractors need to be certified and violators face stiff penalties commensurate with the crimes they commit, we will see compliance. Fines for noncompliance should be very steep and can fund expansion of these programs. While you may have heard that in Oregon, this issue affects hundreds of children each year, please consider that this is a much larger problem. Lead poisoning actually affects many thousands of children in our state, but the demographic that is being poisoned is neither being tested nor counted. Please understand, in the scientific community, the CDC numbers, the number of children stated to be suffering from lead poisoning nationally, are seen for what they are, politically manipulated, gross underestimates, a product of the coercive atmosphere of the politically managed science under the last administration. Through a calculated manipulation of language, child means only those children between the ages of 1 and 5. This excludes countless infants and older children that can still be horribly impacted by the effect of lead on their brains and bodies. My youngest son was just 8 months old when he was poisoned, and by the current definition would not be counted as a child in the official statistics because he was under the age of 1. Poisoned also has been defined only to include children with a BLL of 10 and above, even though the current science has demonstrated that serious damage is done at much lower levels. The NHANES data are too narrow by orders of magnitude, shaped to fit the funding priorities and the message that this problem is well in hand. We will not meet the goal of eradicating childhood lead poisoning by 2010, but the answer is not to dismiss it and pretend the problem has been solved. The answer is to continue to address it by solving the problem, fostering an environment that educates contractors, encourages and rewards lead-safe work practices, and punishes and fines those who poison children. This is best handled by taking the federal guidelines set by the EPA and giving the power to implement and enforce those standards to local agencies like Oregon's DHS. I offer that you take a look at my website for more information about our story and my hopes for legislative change that can be made to protect our children. My website address is mychildrenhaveleadpoisoning.com. In closing, contractors need training, they need oversight, they need standards to be enforced, and violators need to be fined, or your child, your grandchild, your niece or nephew could be one of the next one poisoned. This is just an introduction to try and fit in the time slot here. I have lots of ideas about how to refine these laws to maximize their impact and efficiently leverage limited resources and achieve a significant permanent reduction in childhood lead poisoning, and I'd like to continue to be involved in this process if I can share our story and make a difference. Please let me know if there's anything else I can do to help. And one final thought is that this is a middle-income problem in Oregon, not just a low-income problem. On the East Coast, this is a low-income problem. But here we've got parents that are in the 30 to 50-year-old age range. They know nothing about lead poisoning. They're renovating their homes. They're hiring contractors at top dollar for their historic home to preserve the historical integrity, and they don't know that they're poisoning their children. Somebody has to be responsible, and it can start with educating the contractors and then trickle down to educating pediatricians and parents. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Tamara. For one thing, obviously you had written testimony. If you could give it to Zach, we make copies and make sure that we'll all have it, and I know that we'll want to get on your website.
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming to testify, and I will hear the other people, and then we'll be open up to questions.
Okay. My name is Shelley Lubers. I'm with Inspections Unlimited out of Salem. We are a home inspection company that inspects properties for people in pre-purchase real estate transactions. We have inspectors throughout the state of Oregon. I am the only lead-based paint certified person in our firm. The reason I initially obtained that certification was because of things like this, and I don't even know this lady. So it's because I was sitting in my office watching the neighbor across the street with her child on her front porch in a bassinet scraping the paint off of her 1930 front porch. I said, gosh, this is not okay. Because I'd already had a little bit of training, and this was back in 1990. I'd already had a little bit of training, and I said, you know, this is not okay. So people need to be informed and people need to be trained. I'm not sure that picking up what EPA has done with the ROP program is going to really get to the bottom of where we need to go. I know that the current program we have doesn't go to the bottom. As a certified person, I am required to maintain 4 annual licensing fees in addition to the contractor's fee that I pay for the contractor's board in order to be a risk assessor. It is not a friendly program. to bring in people and increase the numbers of people that are trained to do this, that understand what they're doing. And so I'm really here because I got a call from Oregon Health and said, gosh, we'd love to have somebody come speak. They have no idea what I'm going to say because I haven't really talked to them about it. But essentially, I think that when you put this program together, I'm in support of doing this, but I think you need to think in a broader perspective with relations to how many people can we impact, keep the program inexpensive, get the training there, and make sure that there are employees. The employee piece concerns me. I think it needs to be open for a consultant to come in and monitor these so that your small groups, like you were talking about, have the opportunity not to have to send somebody for a training that's scheduled four times a year. They have the opportunity to bring somebody in that will oversee their project and tell them whether they're doing it right. The mother who's redoing her porch on her own has somebody she can say, come tell me if I'm doing this right. Because that's the bottom line of where we're going to start helping people understand in a bigger scheme. And I think, honestly, all you have to do is walk into Lowe's and know who's doing a lot of the painting, especially of those older homes. So I support the bill that increases the awareness of lead hazards in general. I support one that provides for training of the masses, not just a few, and makes that training cost-effective and affordable for all the contractors and all the individuals out there that are doing it. The scary part of this bill to me is it does not include that. It has an open-ended cost on it that is not contained, and it has a repeated, I have taken the same lead course 3 times. I'm just about ready to take it again because I have to do it every 3 years for continuing it. It's the same. It hasn't changed, like he said. So let's spread it further instead of containing it to, I've taken it 3 times. You know, I know it. Let's get somebody else to know it. And that's where I come from. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming to testify. I really appreciate it. Go ahead. And thank you for waiting so long.
Oh, no worries. My voice is awful. But I was determined to come down today because this is a very important issue to me and to my family. My name is Shaylee Armstrong. I've also provided written testimony, but I don't know if you guys have received a copy or not.
I don't think so.
So I certainly will be sure to have that given to you before the end of the...
We're about to get it now.
Oh, perfect.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm here today. First, I'd like to thank the committee chair and committee members for the opportunity to share my family's experience with hiring a painter and our experience with lead-based paint. In 2005, my husband and I decided to paint the exterior of our home. At the time, we had 2 children, my daughter, Lauren, she's now 7, she was 4 at the time, and my son, Evan, who was 2, and I was 3 months pregnant. We obtained several bids and took the mid-range bid, checked all of the person's references, which were outstanding, contacted the construction contractor's board, and he was licensed and bonded, and he had no issues whatsoever in any kind of history of previous bond issues or complaints through the CCB. We, after the painting started about 2 days when we returned home, they were standing. The painter had indicated he was very knowledgeable in restoration of older homes. Our home was built in 1960, so there are quite a few. Somebody had testified earlier that there are not a lot of homes that, at least that's how I interpreted their testimony, that were built before 1950 that have this issue in Oregon, but there are quite a few homes that are built in 1960 up to 1978 that do have lead-based paint. Ours, unfortunately, was one of them. We came home to our front door ajar, completely open actually, and there was piles of lead, or well, we didn't know it was lead at the time, but paint, debris, and dust. And I had asked the painter why he had the door open, and he said it enabled them to be able to stand better with the door open. So that seemed reasonable. It was messy, but that was something we could deal with. So they left, and that night we went through our normal routine of putting our children to bed. and all of the windows in our home were open, and as we went to go put our children in their rooms, there was just this fine line of paint dust that was under, you know, their beds were under the windows, that was on their bedding, on their toys, and about 3 feet out from where the windows had been open, you could see where they had been painting, you know, chipping the paint and sanding and so forth. This was through the entire house, and we spent probably 6 to 8 hours cleaning that night. We still had no idea what lead-based paint was. Actually, and one of the things that's important in this is that when I asked if they were done sanding that day that we came home and we found all of this, the painter had said, well, we can't continue to sand because we're not real sure if this is lead-based paint or not. That's how we became kind of like, oh my gosh, lead-based paint. So the painting, we moved on. They left. We cleaned everything up, unaware of really what we were dealing with. And because I was pregnant and a little neurotic, we went to Home Depot and got a lead-based paint test kit. They're about $5. And we just tested a little area, and it was bright red. So I started looking online. I contacted DHS, and they started to tell me the process. I contacted the lead-based paint program that they have, and they gave me some names of how to get out of the house, what we needed to do, who to contact as far as testing and all of that. And it led to 8 weeks out of our home, and $30,000 later, we were back in our home with our furniture. All of our items had to be disposed of because the windows were left open, and when the lead blew into our home, it contaminated our couch, our chairs, our bedding, our rugs. Those things can't be washed through a 3-stage process that's required to get rid of the level of lead for it to be safe for our children. So in addition to that, many of their toys were thrown away, their books, and of course I was pregnant, so I thought anything that couldn't be washed was not going to ever be safe because they were so oral and putting things in their mouth. So I'm here today to testify in giving my personal experience in this. It was a tragedy. It was extremely stressful to our family. It was extremely stressful to my pregnancy and extremely stressful to our marriage because we were out of our home for so long. We did have to hire a professional abatement company, and they did a good job. I'm sorry you went through such travesty. You know, that's just, we didn't go through that, but we did go through some of what you went through. My son did have lead in his blood. He didn't suffer brain damage, but because his binkies were dropping on the floor, we were in the home for a week before we found that this was poison, and he was putting that in his mouth, and he had lead in his blood because of that. So I urge that you pass this bill because it gives more accountability to painters, to contractors, and to renovators. It provides more training for them that's under DHS. And although I understand your point, and what is the point of going back for 4 hours of training, it's the same as a social worker. It's the same as a doctor. It's the same as anybody who is in conditions where they're doing something that is related to the environment or to health or to mental health or to anything else. They're all required to go back and do some kind of rebase, retouching, so that they don't lose what they know by heart. But it is so essential to maintain that credibility, to maintain that knowledge, because they are coming into people's homes, and they are, if not trained and not doing things properly, can really make it devastating for the families and for the environment. So that's my testimony. Again, I hope that you support this bill. Our family is one of many that have experienced this. The difference is that we were able to find out information about it. And I often wonder how many people have gone through this ordeal and aren't even aware that it's lead-based paint, and they're living in their homes because they didn't. They just cleaned it up, and they moved on. And because I was pregnant and neurotic, and one painter said the word lead-based is the only reason that this even, we got out of our home and got it safe again. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I'm sorry to hear the story of hard times for you. Thank you.
I just wanted to also address the question of the refresher course, because
For me, with the fact that our painter took a course and failed the exam, I think the refresher course would be really important, both because the technology does change, the tools that they're using changes over time, not since you've been taking it, but there's new technology for paint removal and for doing things safely and better, and new standards based on protocols that are being tested by the EPA. And so a refresher course could be wonderful to impart the new information, or for someone like yourself, they could maybe take an exam to instead of taking the time, and if they don't pass the exam, take the refresher course. But I think it's really important to keep that going, because you forget. Even my husband forgets. He's like, oh, well, I'm just going to use a heat gun on this little space. I'm like, no, you're not. You know, you've been through this. What are you doing? And then he he's like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, you forget, because you don't, especially the contractors aren't taking it personally. And in that way.
Thank you. Any quick questions? Yes, Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Thank you for your testimony, because I think it does get to the heart of the question I had originally. I think as a consumer, you were extraordinary, but because you did ask the right questions. You, in your case, did not get the true answers. But one of my concerns is that this bill just deals with training and certification. But I, as a Head Start director, do not have to comply with looking for this certification. I just simply have to be somehow aware that I should be looking for this certification. So I guess it comes down to a question for Gail.
And we'll have Gail back another time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming today. We really appreciate your stories. Thank you so much for sharing. So we have three other gentlemen, and I don't know who you are, so just come on up, and two gentlemen and a lady. Thank you so much. So, whoever.
Madam Chair, members of the Human Services Committee, my name's Greg Warner. I'm a registered environmental health specialist and a certified lead risk assessor with Multnomah County. I'm involved in the Healthy Homes Program and the Lead Line. As such, I do the disease investigations in Multnomah County for lead-poisoned children. So I see the results of what we're talking about here. And I agree with most everything that's been said. Strongly favor House Bill 2134. To give you a couple recent incidents of investigations, just to bring this to a practical level, there was one case where we had a poisoned child that was living in a rental house. And the family moved out right away. The city had to come in and declare it a hazardous site, and it was posted so it couldn't be rented until they cleaned it up. As it turned out, they had hired a contractor who, when they removed the old paint, had not taken any precautions. The lead dust, the paint chips went all over. It was during the summer. Windows were open. The windowsill near where the child was sleeping had 20 times the federal action level of lead in the dust. The workers had not only done a poor job, they had traipsed through the house and drug it in. Like I say, the lead levels were off the charts in the house and in the yard. Another case was where a neighbor complained that in a house next to theirs, there was ongoing sanding and dust was flying all over the neighborhood. Well, it turned out that this was also a child care center. And in coordination with DHS, we went out and investigated. And sure enough, there were high levels of lead in the yard where the children played and to a certain degree inside. And so that resulted in they had to take actions to clean that up. But my point is that there is this cooperation we have. Multnomah County and DHS confer almost daily about a lot of these cases. And it is very appropriate that they're the ones that handle these rules as opposed to the EPA, which is stationed up in Seattle. Another example was that we had a field closed in artificial turf field closed in Portland. And in cooperation, just to show you how the cooperation works, DHS, Multnomah County, Portland Public Schools, and the Portland Park Bureau all got together and did a study on this field and were able to reopen the field, finding that it wasn't a hazard. So I encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you so much. Go ahead.
Great. Good morning, Chair Tomei in the House and Human Services Committee. Can you hear me okay? All right. My name is Erin McNally. I'm the executive director of the Josiah Hill III Clinic. We are a multicultural, community-based organization that focuses on healthy housing issues. And since our founder, the late Josiah Hill III, began our efforts in the late 90s, we have addressed lead poisoning. Our organization supports House Bill 2134. Our staff frequently speaks with families that come to our free blood lead testing clinics and through our outreach and education that are concerned about remodeling and the impacts it has had on their family, and they're concerned that their child might have an elevated blood lead level. I certainly want to thank the two mothers who shared their personal stories, because it is a very emotional issue and conversation when parents have this concern. Not only is there anger, but there's shame, there's worry. Elevated blood lead levels can cause learning and behavioral disabilities and impact our school systems as well as our juvenile justice systems, too, because of the correlation with learning and with juvenile delinquency. In recent months, I've personally tested a family who had elevated blood lead levels because of remodeling done in the home. By adopting the RRP and the EPA rules in Oregon, contractors will be trained in lead-safe work practices, which would include setting up work areas which do not expose residents to lead hazards, minimizing dust, and leaving the area clean. We would also, as an organization, strongly encourage DHS to adopt clearance testing in the eventual rulemaking. We believe that clearance testing is certainly more stringent than the EPA white glove test, but would actually protect children more. As Tamara mentioned earlier, the abatement company used a white glove test, but when clearance testing occurred, it showed that there were elevated levels of lead and there was a hazard to the family. In addition to adopting the RRP rules, there are benefits to having DHS oversee and enforce the program rather than the EPA. Some have already been mentioned. Obviously, benefits include having a local office, which specifically focuses on Oregon versus a regional office that covers multiple states, quicker response time to complaints and concerns, and also the knowledge of local government agencies and community-based organizations that can be resources to families and to contractors and other local jurisdictions. So again, on behalf of the Josiah Hill III Clinic, I would ask the committee to please pass and support House Bill 2134 to move forward. Thank you for your time.
Where is your health clinic?
We are based in Portland, and we serve the Portland metro area.
Great. Thank you so much.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for the honor to talk to you today. My name is Perry Cabot, and I work for the Community Energy Project in Portland, Oregon. Every year I teach between 55 and 70 public and private lead poisoning prevention workshops in English and Spanish to over 500 Portland area households. I also teach a workshop educating homeowners and renters on lead-safe work practices during small lead paint disturbing home projects. I am a State of Oregon certified lead-based paint risk assessor as well. During the course of my work, I receive many calls and questions from concerned citizens with situations and stories that are truly frightening. Maybe their next-door neighbor is in the process of pressure washing an old garage or a house, and the paint chips have made their yard and child's play area look like a freak snowstorm came by. Maybe the landlord just got done scraping and sanding the exterior of a house while the renters were inside, and now the toddler has a blood lead level that triggers a county health department investigation. Maybe the contractor, who assured them that he knew how to work lead safe, proceeded to open torch burn the old exterior house paint. These calls are real. When they come in to me, I make a referral to the State of Oregon Department of Human Services, lead-based paint program, where there is a person tasked with compliance. But when I make the referral, I feel little hope. I feel little hope for an outcome that might result in a contractor or uninformed landlord truly understanding the potential harm that they've done. The consequences of the unsafe work practices are weighted almost entirely on the children and others who have no choice in the matter. Beyond OSHA-required worker protection, there is no effective enforcement framework that allows for compliance personnel to impose penalties for dangerous work practices. The consequences are on our kids. They are the canaries in our lead mine. With almost half of all childhood lead poisonings in Oregon a result of remodeling activities that disturb lead-based paint, it's clear that the canary has fallen from the perch, and it's long past time that we took action to prevent this danger. If for no other reason, though there are clearly many, the advent of the new EPA rules regarding renovation, repair, and painting demand we confront this issue. Passing House Bill 2134 is an important step in the right direction. Consolidation of certification, accreditation, and enforcement authority under one roof in the hands of trained and knowledgeable staff is the right decision to make at this juncture. This is a step that will make protecting the public from the devastating effects of lead poisoning an easier task. We can act or we can fail to act. I'll close with the words from another who knew well the dangers of lead. On July 31st, 1786, Ben Franklin composed a letter to a friend discussing his observations of the, quote, bad effects of lead taken inwardly. He closes the letter with some words that still resonate today. You will see by it that the opinion of this mischievous effort from lead is at least above 60 years old, and you will observe with concern how long a useful truth may be known and exist before it is generally received and practiced on. And I thank you for the opportunity to share these words.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions of this panel? Thank you so much for coming to testify. Is there anyone else who is not based in the Salem area who would like a quick word with us? Seeing none, I know there were a lot of people who had signed up. We will certainly be having another hearing on this. Gail, I think you've heard some questions from our committee, and I would assume if people have other questions that you will direct them toward Gail so that we can have them answered the next time we meet. Thank you for staying, committee, and I close the hearing on House Bill 21.